required to tell you this is KCSN and KCSN HD1 Northridge KSBR and KSBR HD1 Mission Viejo.
That's our legal name.
But this is the SoCal Sound, member-supported public radio for music lovers. Join us on the SoCal Sound app
and the SoCalSound.org.
A very happy Wednesday evening to you all, and welcome to The Soundtrack. I'm your occasionally genial host, Lev L. Spiro, and tonight we are taking a deep dive into the dark, comedic, and often grisly world of the iconic series Dexter through the ears of one of its chief architects. This gentleman was a writer, a producer on all 8 seasons of the original series, then went on to share executive producer duties on shows like Jessica Jones, Dexter New Blood, Dexter Original Sin. He is now EP, that's fancy lingo for executive producer, he's now EP on the new Showtime hit Dexter Resurrection, which I'm already hooked on, by the way. Please welcome executive producer Scott Reynolds. Scott! Welcome to The Soundtrack.
Thanks for having me here, Lev.
It's a pleasure. We're also joined tonight by the lovely Mimi Chen, who is operating the board. Hi, Mimi. Say hello.
Hello.
Don't be shy. That was really cool what Byron and Mookie just did. They did a whole live thing.
It's wonderful.
And here we are live. There's all kind of liveness happening tonight on the radio right here on the SoCal Sound. Well, listen, I want to get our audience in the mood, so to speak, in the mood for a little murder, and start out with a track that you, Scott, used on the first episode of Dexter Resurrection. And this is called The Big Bad Wolf by The Heaviest. Kind of theatrical and menacing and bluesy and twisted all at the same time. Tell us why this cue plays on screen, or what it plays over, and why you chose the track.
So this was Harrison, who's Dexter's son. Mm-hmm. Has a violent outburst of sorts, right? He meets up with this guy that's a bit of a sexual predator.
Yeah.
Stands up for a woman. They get into a scrum. He can't stop himself. He kills him. And in the lore of the show, you're supposed to sort of wonder, is Harrison like his dad? Is he a stone-cold serial killer or not?
Yeah.
And so he does it. He says a naughty word. And then he starts cleaning it up. And so this song plays over the cleanup, and it's supposed to sort of lead you down this path of like, holy cow, is Harrison a big bad wolf? It's kind of literal. Yeah.
Very cool. Let's take a listen.
It's a cool track too. So, like it, and it's cut like a music video. Marco Siega directed it, and he's directed some of the greatest music videos around. Like it was he and Fincher, and you know all those cats were doing it on TV. So this was his opportunity to create this sort of great kind of violent music video to this great track.
Awesome. Let's take a listen to this. It's from the band The Heavy. This is The Big Bad Wolf.
Ooh.
reliving the scene in my head as I'm listening to this song. When you say clean up, it's a euphemism for chopping a body into pieces and putting it to garbage bags, I think.
Yeah, all the above. Yeah.
Clean up.
And wrapping them up in plastic and cleaning the blood and all that.
Classic Dexter. So, Scott, you have held pretty much every title possible on the writer side of television.
I was a writing assistant the first year of Dexter.
Really? Yeah, a writer's assistant? Okay.
Yeah. I've moved my way up.
Staff writer.
Yeah.
You've now been executive producer on many shows, though.
Yeah.
You're now, of course, one of the primary creative voices alongside showrunner Clyde Phillips. Can you talk to us a little bit about your duties on the show as EP? Are you the on-set person? Are you running the writer's room? Are you doing posts?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Yes to everything.
I run the room. Work with all the writers. You know, during Original Sin, I was doing Dexter Original Sin and Dexter Resurrection. I had two rooms going at the same time.
Wow.
So I was like bopping back and forth, making sure they're on track and hearing their pitches and giving our ideas and saying, let's go that way.
I don't know how you do that. Are you cloning yourself?
You have really great writers that you work with.
Okay.
And that's essential. And then when we have all 10 scripts written, it's kind of different than the way it used to be. A lot of times we're chasing that train, and by episode 7, we start shooting. If there's 22 episodes and you're shooting and writing at the same time.
Right.
We get all 10 scripts done, and then we're done, and then I go shoot. And then I go to New York or Boston or, you know, wherever it is that we're shooting. And then I'm there for the whole run of that and pretty much on set almost every day.
Wow. And you must really love this job. I know how all-encompassing it is. I know that when my wife would go to run a show, I wouldn't see her for the next 9 months.
I would see her,
You would see her, I've been meaning to talk to you about that, actually. That's a
too
separate
tall
conversation. Yeah. Not for me. Well, do you like being on set? I mean, I imagine you have a very close relationship with your director. Marcos is doing – is he doing all the episodes of the
No, it's Marcos Siega and Monica Raymond.
Okay. So they're alternating.
And it was Michael Lehman on Original Sin, who was a classic.
Who was on this show.
I love that man.
He stormed off in a huff. He said he would never come back. But
I mean, that's so Lehman.
Yeah.
I work with both the directors. We tone the scripts and say these are the things we're looking for in each of the scenes. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things I learned both from Clyde and from Melissa, just how important that is.
Yeah.
So that nobody's lost,
right.
You know, and they keep it in their scripts and they look and they know and I'm on set just to make sure that all those things are sort of hit. And because if you're, I mean, you know, as a director, there are 700, there's 250 people coming at you at all time with so many questions. And it's hard. I think it's hard to sort of keep track of things.
My favorite quote is a first-time director who has made the transition from being actor said their experience directing was like being pecked to death by a herd of angry chickens. I thought that's a very good analogy.
Yeah. Yeah. How about this? Is this good? I don't know. Yeah.
But I always liked, you know, when you have a good relationship with a writer on set, you've got another fantastic brain with you that's picking up the slack. And, you know, if I'm focused on making a shot work and I'm losing the emotional through line of the characters in the scene, and a writer says, doofus, you're missing the whole point here. They don't usually say
we never say that.
No, not to my
face. And Marcos and I and Monica and I, we worked so well together and relied on each other all the way through.
Yeah.
It was great. And then doing posts now, like was it this morning? Yeah. We were working on the final mix of episode 9.
Wow.
And it's so weird now because back in the day, you'd actually go to a production house and go sit in that big, beautiful, dark room projected and the speakers all around you.
Yeah. What are you doing now?
And now it's on Clearview and Zoom and with my headphones on. And
not quite the same.
But what I do appreciate about it, though, is that I'm hearing it the way that you hear it for real.
Because,
you know, those rooms, the sound is so perfect.
Hmm.
But I listen to it on my little Sonos, right?
Well, speaking of music, of course, when we were talking about your EP duties, you are helping or wholly deciding what music to put in. You mentioned the track we just heard. You had scripted.
Yeah. A lot of I'm kind of nutty that way. That if I write to music a lot, I have a lot of stuff like soundtracks and whatever. But I sometimes listen to records that hit me. You know, got a lot of vinyl that helps. But a lot of times a song, like I'll be writing and the song will hit me and then I'll go put it on the platter and I'll listen to it and write the scene. And it's almost like I'm cutting it in my head, you know, in some ways.
Sure.
And then I just put it in the script. So
that can be very inspirational. That
yeah,
way.
Yeah. Big bet. And if it works, it's great. There was a, there's, we'll get to the other song later.
Okay. Yeah, well, yeah. One of the things I love about the music you guys put on this show is how eclectic you are in your choices. Yeah. Tell us about this next track. You're using an iconic punk anthem by the Ramones as Dexter drives into New York City at the end of the first episode.
So first of all, Blitzkrieg Bop is my go-to karaoke song. If you need a song, it's
you do the Ramones for karaoke?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. It's like a little over 2 minutes long.
Okay.
Everybody, you can get everybody singing along. Uh-huh. You don't have to be a good singer.
All right.
So I'm just giving you that little pro tip there. So the song, it's toward the end of the pilot episode, and we've seen, and Dexter is arriving in New York City, and he's crested. There's this big, beautiful drone shot or helicopter shot. He's cresting this bridge, and "Hey Ho, Let's Go" starts to play, and we want the audience to be like, "Yes, Dexter, let's go, Hey Ho."
Listening to the soundtrack, and our guest tonight is Dexter executive producer Scott Reynolds. Scott, we're going to circle back and play a whole bunch more tracks from Dexter Resurrection. But first, I asked you last week to share some of your favorite musical moments from film, and you had some amazing ones. I loved your choices. You were talking about singing in the rain in Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange and Layla in Goodfellas, as well as Dick Dale's surf rock Miserloo over the opening of Pulp Fiction. So I'm feeling kind of a delicious common thread here with these choices.
Oh, yeah. I mean, other than Miserloo, the other two are very much, they're sort of playing against what you're seeing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it funny, and it makes you kind of uncomfortable sometimes, too. Like, when he's singing, there's no way. Look, on Dexter, we've had trouble getting some songs. Sometimes people are just like, we don't want to be associated with a serial killer
right.
show.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, we try to convince them, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I can't imagine singing in the rain with what's going on in that scene. It's like this horrific... Yeah. rape and violence and kicking each other, and he starts singing the song, and it you find yourself laughing all of a sudden.
It was a bold choice
and it makes you like uncomfortable that you are responding the way that you are, like, and I love that sort of thing. You know, Tarantino does that a whole bunch and like Reservoir Dogs
I love that mixing of comedy and horror and the irony it produces. I mean, I kind of feel like that's one of the essential DNA strands of Dexter. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that completely, 100%. Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
We like making people feel uncomfortable.
Hey,
was King of the Surf Guitar, Dick Dale, with Miser Lou right here on the SoCal Sound. And because I'm such an amazing host, I cut you off, Scott, right as you're about to explain why we're playing Miser Lou, please.
Yeah, I mean, this was a brain buster when this thing happened. So I went to college at Eastern Michigan University, my second college after the first one I got in trouble at.
Yeah.
And I was working in a movie theater. And I always loved movies and TV, and really I loved movies a lot, and books, and in theater. I was a theater major like you know. And I would screen The Prince on Thursday nights at midnight, and I'd known about this Tarantino because of Reservoir Dogs. I had the VHS tape of it, and then I screened this print at midnight, and you know, there's that amazing first scene, any of you. People move. I'm going to execute every last one of you. The coffee shop. And then this song kicks in, and I was in heaven. I was like, this is everything that you can do with a soundtrack. It assaults you, and it like propels you into the movie.
Wow.
And I've never been a surf rock guy. Yeah. I didn't, you know, I grew up in the Midwest.
Right.
I don't even watch surfer movies or beach bank.
The surfing is terrible. Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really bad. But in that moment, I was just like, I have to pursue this thing. And I, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that I shut up long enough for you to tell that story.
Thank you, Quentin Tarantino.
You grew up in Chicago.
Yes.
And you grew up in a deeply evangelical Christian household. And told me how you were mostly steeped in Christian rock music you got to college.
Yeah.
But you also said you were kind of an alternative punky Christian kid. Am I getting that right?
I was hardcore punk. Yeah.
So I had
a faux hawk and I had earrings, which was like crazy.
Wow. So where did leaning into punk come from? Was that a form of rebellion for you?
Yeah.
Not rebellion from faith necessarily, but you know, was it rebellion against something else? Or
it was, well, I didn't want to be like my parents, but I also had, you know, I had this great fear that I was going to go to hell or that Jesus was going to come back and I'd wake up in the morning and the rapture would happen and I'd be left alone and get my head chopped off. You know, the normal things that people... it's insane.
Do heads come off in the rapture? I thought
No. It's we just after, get left, right? After the Antichrist take... You know, that's all those like Left Behind movies and all that. There was these movies called Thief in the Night that really just scared the poop out of us when we were kids. And so we wanted to be really... you know, obey God. And as a result, but I also loved music and I loved punk rock. But there was, lucky for me during that time, I'm not there anymore at all, really. But I look back on it fondly and I look back, you know, the thing that's so great about music when you're 10, when you're 14, 15, 16, 17 years old, they're singing about things that really mean something to you.
Yeah.
You remember and back then you had to save up for that record, tape cassette, or CD, depending on the time period, and you knew every single word, and the words to a lot of those songs also were attached to like believing in something bigger than myself, and so they were really they kept me on the straight and narrow, and they made me feel different, and they.
I feel like there's a movie in this about your life growing up in Chicago. I
thought about it
as a punk evangelical Christian kid.
I lived right next to a commune called the Jesus People.
Yeah.
Jesus People USA.
But they were like the hippies, right?
They were just, they were everything you'd think about a hippie, but like talking about Jesus all the time.
Well, listen, I didn't know anything about Christian rock. I asked you to send me some samples, and this one I'm going to play next really surprised me in a way that you were just talking about. I would never know that it's a Christian group from listening to this song. It's a smart, kind of ironic song with a sense of ironic detachment, and they're singing about media and the effect it has in our lives and how it kind of distracts us from things that are important. You know, it's nobody's praising anything, that's for sure. And it's also like happens to be this kind of cool retro new wave song.
Daniel Amos, they weren't singing songs that were like praise songs or anything like that. They were just singing about life and being funny about it. And every once in a while, there'd be like a song about God, but if you didn't know it, you wouldn't know it, which was, I really liked that too.
Well, I really like this one. This is from the vault of our guest, Scott Reynolds. This is Daniel Amos, and the song is Travelogue.
To my private shore, my boat's on
We're talking with Dexter executive producer Scott Reynolds. Scott, you told me that it wasn't until switching colleges in your early 20s that you started being exposed to music outside the Christian sphere. Yep. What was that like for you?
It was great. My my sister started dating this guy, Trey Manny.
Trey Manny.
Who is now a booking agent, but he was in a bunch of bands. Okay. His Name is Alive and Pride of the Lion. Who else? Velour 100. He was a drummer in a bunch of bands.
Okay.
And he had great music taste.
Mm-hmm.
And so, suddenly I'm listening to, like, Cocteau Twins and, like, you know, bands like that where I'm just, my mind is just expanding and I'm loving all of it. And then I'm going back in time and realizing so many, like, one of my favorite Christian rock bands was the Altar Boys, who are like a Southern California staple now, uh-huh. You know? And that was back in the 80s. And then he was like, oh, you should check out the Replacements.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, those guys just flat out did the Replacements. Which it's fine because, you know, we all bite on artistry.
Everybody, you know? Borrows from
each
other.
Yeah.
It's homage.
Yeah, so that was fun, just sort of going like, oh, that song by the 77s was actually a Led Zeppelin track, you know.
There's a quote I'm fond of, is, mediocre artist copy, great artist steal.
I'm with that.
You also mentioned that amongst your favorite bands was U2. You said U2
they bridged the gap.
Everything is what you said. U2 yeah. was everything. Please explain.
Well, you know, I was a youth group kid, like at my church, you know, I was like president of youth group. I was way into it. And then this band U2 starts coming out with Boy, and the word on the street was like Bono and not The Edge, the drummer.
Yeah, Adam Clayton.
They were like youth group kids, and they came out of like a Bible study in Ireland or something, you know?
Wow.
And so I was just like, oh, and it sort of like bridged the gap between the pure sort of Christian rock stuff
sure.
and what you can do and the stories you can tell when you don't just like lock yourself into this one thing. And yeah, U2, they just got better and better.
Like, well, it sure makes sense to me. They do seem like a giant bridge between your evangelical roots and something more universal, I'll say.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I sure remember being completely bowled over by this album when it came out. Check it out. This is U2.
Oh, yeah.
That was In God's Country by U2. From the Joshua Tree, you may have noticed this is a different song. From a band called Black Sabbath. We're going to hear why Scott fought to get this track for Dexter right after this.
This is your captain speaking. We've checked all the doohickeys, knobs, buttons, meters, and switches, and our aircraft is ready to go. Still not sure what that flashing red light means. Jet Into Work departs every weekday at 6 a.m. Thank you for starting your day with the SoCal Sound.
As you may have heard, Congress voted to rescind over $1 billion of funding to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, marking a devastating blow for public media, including us. The SoCal Sound will lose $125,000 this year. We held a historical one-day rally drive to bridge that funding gap, but we came up a little bit short. But if you didn't and want to keep independent programming on the air, please give as generously as possible right now at thesocalsound.org.
Lander, the SoCal Sound has tickets for Blade Runner Live at Dolby Theater on January 21st. You can find contest rules and enter to be eligible for a pair of tickets at thesocalsound.org. No purchase necessary. Tickets are on sale now at dolbytheater.com. Blade Runner Live, Dolby Theater, January 21st.
Support comes from iLead Exploration, an accredited TK through 12th grade public charter school, open to all with no tuition required. Guide your child's learning journey at home in partnership with credentialed teachers and counselors, serving Los Angeles, Orange, Kern, Ventura, and San Bernardino counties. More information is available at iLeadExploration.org.
Support for the SoCal Sound comes from Subaru of Glendale as you gear up for your summer escapes. From daily drives to weekend adventures, Subaru delivers all-terrain capability, Subaru safety, and technology to keep you moving with confidence. Subaru of Glendale is on Brand Boulevard just off the 5 and 134 freeways. More at SubaruofGlendale.com. That's SubaruofGlendale.com.
Thank you for listening to 88.5 The SoCal Sound, your public music radio station. We play music that's hand-selected by local, passionate DJs and only break once an hour to recognize our sponsors. When you become a station sponsor or program underwriter, you help continue the mission to discover and share new and local artists in SoCal. As a business owner or individual, you can join us in building a stronger music community while building positive branding and awareness for your organization. Visit thesocalsound.org and click Become a Sponsor to learn more.
Julie Slater, your midday host. This week, we are going to dive into the second album from the five-piece from the Isle of Wight, Wet Leg, and their new record, Moisturizer. Tune in every weekday this week, just after 12 noon, to hear some tracks off of Wet Leg's new record. It's our 88.5 album dive on the SoCal Sound.
We're back. I'm your host, film and TV director Lev L. Spiro, and our guest tonight is Dexter producer extraordinaire Scott Reynolds. Scott, is this more fun so far than Sharp Sticks in the Eye?
Way more fun. And, you know, I love Wet Leg too, so that was cool.
Is it more fun than being wrapped in plastic and murdered?
No, that's pretty fun.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Well, listen, this next song is a beast. Also, it gave me giggles to play it back to back with In God's Country. We're talking about Black Sabbath's song War Pigs. It's an amazing opener to episode 2. Tell us why War Pigs and how did you get it without blowing the entire music budget for the season?
All good questions. The scene that's happening is we're following this guy walking near, you know, walking in Manhattan. We find out it's the Dark Passenger, who's a serial killer who gets in ride shares. You know, they'll be like, hey, are you Johnny? He'd be like, yeah, I'm Johnny. He'd get in the backseat of the car and then put a Geely saw around their neck.
Yes.
And saw off their heads.
Saws their heads off.
Yeah. Pretty gnarly. And we wanted like a song that creates a sense of menace. And what's funny is we were kind of bounce, Marcos and I and Clyde were bouncing songs back and forth with each other. And then Marcos goes, I have a song. And I'd had a song too the night before also. He's like, I got a perfect song. It's a Black Sabbath song. And I said, War Pigs. And he was like, yeah, it's War Pigs. And then, you know, of course, the question is,
you had a weird psychic connection.
Yeah. But it just fits perfect when you see it. But then that comes the big question is how do you not break the budget for the thing? So our amazing music supervisor, Sean Fernald, went to work trying to get the song, and it came back very expensive.
Yeah.
And then
one would imagine
for publishing and then for, you know, there's sync like rights. Sync rights. There's all these things you got to get. And then we were like, well, you know, it's kind of worth it. We'll go for it. And then they doubled it.
Oh, nice.
So then, yeah. And we're like, well, this stinks. Yeah. Luckily, Marco Siega had a relationship with the Osbournes. Mm-hmm. He did like a music video for Sharon. No, for the daughter back in the day, and spent like 2 weeks at their house back in the height of their reality TV show that they had, which was like fabulous. You know, God bless Ozzy Osbourne. I miss him.
Yeah.
But so he wrote this beautiful note, sent it over there, and then Sean Fernald, who used to work for Capitol Records and has all these amazing relationships with everybody, sort of worked his way, and we got the song.
Lo and behold. Amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
It does work incredibly well. I noticed you like starting each episode with a jolt of musical energy. You use War Pigs and Alt J's Left Hand Free.
Yeah.
Is the idea to reel viewers in right from the get-go?
Yeah. You know, again, I think there's a lot that comes down to both between... You know, Clyde's a very musical guy, plays guitar all the time. Marcos was the music video dude of the 90s, right? In the early 2000s, I mean. And then I love music too. So, yeah, we want to hit it hard and get you excited, you know?
Cool. Well, here is our recently departed Ozzy in fine voice, along with Tommy Iommi on guitar, Geezer Butler on bass, and Bill Ward on drums, with a song that helped define a genre, War Pigs.
Gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah. We'll be right back.
I sure hope some of you were headbanging out there.
Your air guitar was amazing. Like.
Thank you. There's nothing wrong with a little headbanging, right? As long as it's consensual, right, Scott?
That's right.
I love that cut in the episode. I understand why you guys went to bat for it. And as a big fan of the original series, I have to say it's been really fun getting to love Dexter Morgan all over again. Michael C. Hall is better than ever in this thing. All the characters are. It must be really fun to write that character again.
Yeah, I've loved Dexter from the very beginning. So it's amazing that 20 years later, we're still able to let him roam around. And New York, of all places. It's great.
Well, this next track made me laugh out loud. Sorry, if you're under 25, that means LOL. This next track made me LOL when I saw it. You have a police detective in the new show who likes to listen to music through headphones while she's focusing. And in this scene, she is... What is she doing in this scene, Claudette?
She is a garbage guy was sorting some trash, and suddenly a leg and an arm fell out.
Yes.
And so she is looking for the rest of the body because, as she says, it's Katia Saraf, and she's incredible at it. But as she says, you cannot identify a body by a toe or a head. A toe or a foot. I forget what it was.
Okay.
So she's looking for a corpse, the rest of a chopped up corpse.
And you, Scott Reynolds, decided to set this to the Bee Gees. Please explain yourself.
Again, it goes to these feelings that we have for Clockwork Orange and Singing in the Rain. Staying alive as a homicide detective looks for someone that is dead.
Yeah. Well, here you go, folks. Disco meets dismemberment. This is Staying Alive.
New York Times.
folks, you're listening to the soundtrack right here on the SoCal Sound, and our guest tonight is Dexter executive producer Scott Reynolds. Scott, you were telling us that you went for another song originally,
yeah,
not Staying Alive.
We wanted The Hustle. It's part of the song The Hustle, and we tried for it, and Sean Fernald did everything he could, but they were just like, absolutely not. We want nothing to do with the Serial Killer Show.
Yeah.
And then we were just sort of bouncing songs back and forth, and Staying Alive came up. I think Marcos came up with Staying Alive, and it was like, well, there's no way. And Sean was like, let me give it a try. And the song hasn't been used on a TV show ever, and really hasn't been used since that iconic movie. It's been people have used it for not this track. They've covered it or whatever, you know, other. But this is the first time it's been used. So at first they were sort of like said no, and then Sean reached out and actually reached out to one of the Gibbs, mm-hmm. and pitched him what this song means, mm-hmm. and how it's this pursuit of justice, and how it's this cop who, this is the way that she, you know, she's possibly on the spectrum, and whenever she really needs to focus, she puts this song on and blurs out the world and achieves justice, you know?
I hope Sean is listening to the show, because you're doing a great job pitching him for all his next decade of shows.
Honest to God, he's one of the greatest I've ever worked
with. There you go.
But to go that hard to get the song, and then we got the song, and as you see, we're going to play it multiple times throughout the season with a perfect payoff, if I may say so myself.
Yeah. Yes, and don't give anything away, because I'm a huge fan. Yeah, no spoilers.
And that
please.
Was quite a dance you were doing while that was going, man. I had
no idea
you had those kind of moves.
I worked on that for you before I came in. Well, we were just talking about Sean, your music supervisor. So tell me, when you first sat down with him, how did you describe the tone that you're going for? What was your approach to this iteration musically of Dexter?
Well, again, a lot of times the songs are actually in the script. You know, there's in episode 4, which I think you said you just watched,
yep.
there's like this moment where this song by Scrounge called Badoom comes
yeah.
up.
Uh-huh.
So the tone is very much there. When we're talking to, yeah, and then he pitches us ideas if things don't clear, or sometimes he'll just be like, I think this song would work really well in this moment. And it will enhance the thing, and this pitch works too. You know?
Well, speaking of songs that work great in the moment, we're going to listen to a song by the Stone Foxes. This is I'm a King Bee.
That was the Stone Foxes with their single "I'm a King Bee," coming to a Dexter episode near you in the next few weeks. No, it was
episode three.
I take that one back, Scott. We haven't spoken yet about working with composers.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy working with them? Are you very hands-on with suggestions? Do you prefer stepping back and giving more general notes? How do you like to do it?
Well, I learned from Clyde Phillips as he was working with Daniel Licht.
Yeah.
on their OG show. Mm-hmm. When I was like an assistant, I would go with him to the house, mm-hmm. to Daniel Licht's house,
yeah.
and we'd give notes on. He'd give notes on the tracks, and I'd take the notes down, and it was. So I had a firsthand experience of it all, and so now we're working with Pat Irwin, who's from the B-52s, an incredible artist, and he, yeah, we work. It's always like a little bit of a scary thing to ask an artist to. Follow some other artist,
right?
You know, because we wanted everybody to feel the Daniel Licht sort of Dexter
right.
themes,
right.
but also we don't want Pat Irwin to do Daniel Licht themes, right?
Yeah.
We want him to find his way into the sort of Dexter feel. Yeah, it's real fun doing that. It's real fun watching. Like we'll sort of tone the episode, and we'll watch scenes that we want music in because when we're editing it, we'll put in. Tracks from other shows, you know, like other songs.
Sure.
And then
temp music.
Thank you. You're a director. And then we'll sit with Pat and say, here's the thing that we're looking to feel in this moment.
So do you give notes mostly in terms of emotional turns?
Yes.
What you're trying to get out of the scene?
Yeah. Well, and then he'll present it to us, and 9 times out of 10 it's amazing. And sometimes it's like, you know, you could slide this thing over or maybe punch this a little bit more or you might have hit that too hard this time, you know. Yeah, it's fun to do.
Really interesting. We talked earlier about using music to create irony. We talked a lot about it, staying alive over searching for body parts. What about actual comedy scenes? You're not creating the comedy with the music in, you know, counterpoint to what's going on, but the scene itself, the comedy's in the dialogue or the action. Do you like score? Do you like needle drops? What's your approach to comedy from a musical standpoint?
Probably more needle drops than score.
Okay,
you know. Otherwise, it sounds like Mickey Mouse or something. You know, if
well,
the score is making you laugh,
yeah.
then maybe what you wrote doesn't work.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Dave Hemmingson calls it that kind of like if you have this bad pizzicato score, it's like this the fake laugh track.
You're telling people,
hey, this is supposed to be funny. You should be laughing at it.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, here's one where you went with a needle drop. And this song plays over Dexter's son, Harrison, trying to dismember his first victim. Right? This is Bad Decisions?
Yeah.
Okay. This is Bad Decisions by The Strokes.
Yeah.
You've been listening to The Soundtrack with guest Scott Reynolds. And folks, sadly, we are almost out of time for tonight. Scott, it has been an absolute pleasure. I love your approach to music. I love the new show. I can't wait to